I'm Kenny Withers, College Department Editor for Holt, Reinhart & Winston Publications in English, Literature, and Language. We have arranged for interviews, conversations rather, between Cleanth Brooks and Robert Penn Warren on the one hand, and four distinguished American poets on the other. The subject of these conversations is meter and other technical aspects of verse. The subject is ordinarily dull and fruitless, especially on the voiceless page of a textbook. We had thought that informal discussion by poets might bring new life and light to the subject. We've not been disappointed.
The first session is with Robert Frost. Mr. Frost, I once heard you say that for a poem to stick, it must have dramatic accent.
If it doesn't, it will not stay in anybody's head. It won't be catchy.
How about it, Mr. Brooks?
No, it won't stick.
Catchiness has a lot to do with all of it, all the way up. From the ballads you hear on the street and the lines in Shakespeare that stay with you without you trying to remember them are just, they're catchy. They stick on you like birds thrown on you in holiday foolery. You don't have to try to remember them. That's from this the way they're said, you know, an archness or something, you know.
Well, I'm sure you're right about the dramatic quality being the basic quality of good poetry. That would bring up the relation of meter and rhythm to the dramatic moment by a moment in a poem, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's right.
I'd like to hear you say it in your way, how meter enters into this picture, the dramatic quality.
The meter seems to be the basis of the wave. You saw the wave, and seems to, in the beat of the heart, it seems to be basic in all making of poetry in all languages. There's some sort of meter.
It has the strain of the rhythm against the meter.
Yes.
Is that itself just a dramatic fact that permeates a poem?
From those two things rises what we call this tune that's different from the tune that we of music, the other kind of music. It's a music of itself. And when people say that this will easily turn into be set to music, I think it's bad writing.
If it's easily set
it
to
ought
music.
To fight them being yeah. set to music yeah. if it's got expression in it.
Yes, yes.
Ought to fight them.
Yes, there's something resistant and yeah. unique in it.
Yeah.
You can't just
yeah.
turn it into something else.
Yeah.
This is to overstate a matter, but I do want to get it clear. If I can for myself, would you say that even though the meter is based on the human pulse or some kind of basic rhythm in our natures, still for the poet it's something to be played over against, it's something to be fought with, it's
yeah,
something to be tussled
right.
with, it's not directly expressive.
No.
It's
doggerel when you
yes,
do that.
Yes.
You
yes.
see, and how you save it from doggerel is having enough dramatic meaning in it for the other thing to yes. break the doggerel. And it mustn't break with it. I said years ago that it reminds me of a donkey in a donkey cart. For some of the time, the cart is on the tugs, and some of the time it's on the holdbacks. You see, the cart
yes.
that way all the time. The one's doing that to the other. The one's holding the thing back, and the other's pushing it forward, and so on, back and forward. So I puzzled over it many years and tried to make people see what it meant. They use the word rhythm about a lot of free verse. And, gee, what's the good of the rhythm unless it is on something that trips it, that it ruffles, you know. It's got to ruffle the meter.
Isn't this the fault of, to name a name of a man who did write some very fine poems, I think? Vachel Lindsay, it depends too much on just the...
Your doggerel.
The doggerel,
yeah.
the dead stamp of the...
Sing song.
Yes.
Yes, and you know, when he had something else, he thought he ought to put a note about it in the margin.
Yes.
Do you notice
tell
that?
Tell you how to read it.
Say this in
yes.
a golden zone, he says.
Yes.
You ought not to have to say that in the margin.
No, no.
That ought to be
built in
the meaning.
Yes.
Yeah, the meaning does that. This is why you have to have a meaning, because you don't know what to do with anything if you don't have a meaning. To make you act up, you got to act up. What sayest thou, old barrel full of lies? Chaucer said, you know, what do you say, old barrel full of lies? And you can hear it talk just the same today. And all of it. That's why it exists. It's a beautiful, anywhere you look into Chaucer. Since I from love escaped am so fat, I never think to have been in his prison lane. Since I am free, I count him not a bean. This is Chaucer talking to her. Just same now, I hear the country people talk in England and here with these same ways of acting up, put it that way, calling it acting up. You act up when you talk. Some do more than others. Some little children do. Some just seem to be rather straight line, you know. But some switch their whole body when they talk, switch their skirts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Expressiveness comes over them. Words aren't enough. And of course, all before words came the expressiveness. Groans and murmurs and things like that emerging into words. And a few of those sounds linger, like mm-hmm and mm-mm and mm-hmm, and all our groans. And by myself sometimes I groan at something already done that I'd like to avert. It's
from a groan to a sonnet's a straight line.
Yeah. That's right.
As you're distinguishing then the meaning in the most limited sense from the overall felt meaning of the whole thing, is that it?
That's your whole guide, the overall meaning.
That's your guide, yeah. And your end product.
Yeah, and your end product. And also, if you know, one of the funny things is that this mood you're writing in, it foretells the end product, see, that begins out of that way, and a way of talking that foretells the end product. There's a logic of that sort of thing. Somebody said, to be a master writer, you don't have to wait for your moods. That'd be like Browning, and as he got older, you get to be a virtuoso, and you aren't a poet anymore. He'd lost his moods somewhere.
Yes, yes.
Got to be a master.
Yes.
We don't want to be masters.
In other words, you don't want even to be master, is this right, of the particular poem before you started. You're moving from mood to the exploration of the mood, is that
that's
it?
Right.
Poem
right.
As a discovery. Fine.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. You're on a little voyage of discovery. And there's a logic in it. You're going to come out somewhere with great certainty, and you can tell whether you've lost it on the way, and you throw the poem away if you lose it.
Yes.
Down the years, looking back over it all. And you see, a good many who think they're writing free verse are really writing old-fashioned iambic, a good deal of Whitman's like that. And a lot of Masters is like that.
Yes.
He just never got away from blank verse, the sound of blank verse. And so there are places where this thing takes place that I'm talking about. There's both the meter and the expressiveness on it, and so we get a poem. Ezra Pound used to say that, oh, you got to get all the meter out of it, extirpate the meter. And that's not... If you do, maybe you got true free verse, and I don't want any of it.
Well, you can go at it another way. I guess it's Winters who says that behind all good free verse... I may be misinterpreting him, but I think it's what he says. Behind all good free verse, there's a shadow of formal verse.
That's right. And if we hadn't had the years of formal verse, this stuff wouldn't be any good, you know. It's the shadow is there. That's what gives it any charm it has. See, I'm hard on free verse a little. Too hard, I know.
Would you be hard, Mr. Frost, also on the business of the beatniks and chanting poetry to jazz? Is that let too much of the music, the wrong side of music come in?
Absolutely. Yeah, death. Hang them all. You know, this fellow's going to talk with me, A.P. Herbert, from London tomorrow. They've told me what his prejudices are, you know, to see if they couldn't rouse me to say something to him. He's in favor of hanging delinquent children. So that's one of his prejudices. And he'd be in favor of exterminating the free verse writers, I'm pretty sure. I'm not as bad as that. Let's put it this way, that the prose and verse are alike in having high poetic possibilities of ideas. See? And free verse is anywhere you want to be between those two things, prose and verse. I like to say guardedly that I could define poetry this way. It is that which is lost out of both prose and verse in translation. See, that means something in the way the words are mm-hmm. curved and mm-hmm. And all that, the way the words are taken, the way you take the words. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The best order notion. The old Coleridgean best order notion. That,
yeah. That's pretty... I'm pretty extreme about it. You know, I've given offense by saying that I'd as soon write free verse as play tennis with the net down. I want something there, the other thing, the other something to hold and something for me to put a strain on. And I'd be lost in the air with just cutting loose. And thus I'm in my other mood of making it prose right out, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. And I don't write much of that, but I have... That's another thing.
Then good free verse would have a hypothetical net.
Yes, that's right.
I suppose.
That's right.
The shadow of a net across there. You pretend is that.
Almost invisible nylon net, but there.
May I break in here? Do you feel, Mr. Frost, there is such a thing as a basic English meter?
You hardly ever get a word that you can't fit into iambic with us.
Yes.
There's once in a while something that's got two or three syllables you don't know what to do with, but that's rather rare. Mm-hmm. And words like begin or begin, you know, it's established. And you we're brought up almost to it. I've got that established in me from babyhood, from Mother Goose and all that. And one line of the first line of a poem is my guide. Mm-hmm. That ought to be rather a little more definite than any other, give you a clue about what the meter is going to be underneath it. And you can play hob with it, you can do almost break with it, but you got to have it there.
Something to break from.
The what?
Something to break from.
Yeah, to break from. If I break with it, I'm no good, I've lost.
To come so close to breaking, but then it all resolves
That's
and comes right again.
It's fun. That's fun.
One of the things that seemed very interesting to me was the fact that your blank verse was so idiomatic, so much like conversation, so much your own. It wasn't Miltonic blank verse at all, although we'd had centuries of Miltonic blank verse.
It was my own rhythms on it.
It wasn't Shakespeare, it wasn't Wordsworthian.
No.
I wonder if you would read a few lines for us from one of the blank verse poems. I have my own nomination, but you may prefer to.
All right.
I'd like for you to read a little of The Code.
The Code,
Code.
You tell me what part, will you?
That fine conversational passage in which he's explaining to the town-bred farmer.
I'll do that. What was there wrong? See? What was there wrong? See, that would be the meter. What was there wrong? Something you just now said. What did I say? See? I'm almost hiding the meter.
Yes.
About our taking pains. To cock the hay, because it's going to shower. I said that more than half an hour ago. I said it to myself as much as you. You didn't know. You didn't know. But James is one big fool. He thought you meant to find fault with his work. That's what the average farmer would have meant. James would take time, of course, to chew it over before he acted. He's just got round to act. Get that? See what I mean?
Yes.
Just got round to act. He's just got round to act, yes. Then he says, he is a fool if that's the way he takes me. See, all that straight meter.
Straight meter and yet very expressive, very idiomatic.
Dramatic. The way you want it in the theater. And it's funny they don't see that. Tell me where is fancy bred? In the heart or in the head? You know.
It's natural enough.
Yeah, it's natural. Talks right on. Talks as well
off
as having its little tune. It's a song. And I like to think, I know that I depend for my existence on getting that in. That's my existence. My pleasure and my existence. And I feel sorry for some of these fellows that think they can say a poetic thing in same sentence all the time, one statement after a statement, like an editorial, you know, unrelieved by any airs to put on. You got to act up.
You are a man who knows the classics, you know the Latin and Greek and so on, but
Brought up in them.
Brought up in them, but the quantitative verse, though it's Latin and Greek, is not doesn't sort with the genius of English.
You know, I've got a piece of verse in here that is the only imitation of anything Latin, and none of my Latin people have recognized it. They think it's just some of my regular iambics, but it's hendecasyllables.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, it's called "For once then something." Oh, that's it. "Others taunt me with having knelt at well curves, always wrong to the light, so never seeing deeper down in the well than where the water gives me back in a shining surface picture, me myself in the summer heaven, godlike, looking out of a wreath of fern and cloud puffs. Once, when trying with chin against a well curve, I discerned, as I thought, beyond the picture, through the picture, a something white, uncertain, something more of the depths, then I lost it. Water came to rebuke the too clear water. One drop fell from a fern, and lo, a ripple shook whatever it was lay there at bottom, blurred it, blotted it out. What was that whiteness? Truth, a pebble of quartz? For once then, something. Well, now that is hendecasyllables, a very strict performance. You see, let's take a line like, water came to rebuke the too still water. Water came, and then this too is the one mark of the hendecasyllable, that line, there's one extra syllable in there, turns it from iambic into hendecasyllable, and it's nothing, it's perfectly negligible. I did it with my daughter when she was in college, and I just said, let's each do some hendecasyllables, and I did that, and it turned out better poem than it ought
very
to be
much.
As an exercise. But I had an interest in the old things, but I broke with it all. I still go to see how well anybody does his Odyssey. I've just been looking at an Odyssey by a man named Rouse.
Yes.
You know it?
Yes.
And do you know what he's... It says, the only begetter of this translation is Ezra Pound,
yes.
in a little note. Ezra showed a lot of people how to be vernacular with that old Greek stuff, that is, get it somewhere near our speech, away from the artificial.
Yes.
And he brought something fresh to that translation business, right in a lot of it in England. They listened to him talk.
Yes.
And then I heard Whaley, the Chinese translator, say very generously in England this last time I was over, because he didn't know one word of Chinese, he said. He couldn't translate anything. But he just takes the thing I've done, and I confess he does something to him.
It makes some poetry.
Yes. It makes some poetry, and makes them with a flavor of Chinese that you wouldn't think you could get, you
yes.
know.
Yes.
That's a curious story.
But I take it that the so-called timers, the quantitative people, don't have, you would feel, anything finally to tell us about English meter.
No.
Our genius is iambic.
Yeah. Ours is a very simple waving, you know, length, simple, and then on that, the dramatic expression.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives poetry a greater value, dramatic value, than any poetry has ever had.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Frost, I have a poem I'd like you to look at and perhaps make some comment on. It's one by John Crow Ransom. It's called Bells for John Whiteside's Daughter. I'll read the first stanza. There was such speed in her little body and such lightness in her footfall. It is no wonder her brown study astonishes us all.
That's one from Ransom.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gee, and you know, he's so good at it.
Yes, he's good at it, all right.
He's one of those that I never would be bothered, troubled by. You know, he's so good, and there's such a pretty attitude of expression all through him on the meter, and the meter's all right too.
A very delicate ear.
Yeah, very
yes.
delicate. Yeah. That's that pretty thing. Astonishing, her brown study. Yeah, pretty thing. He's one of the few people that that I've cared extremely about, you know. Do you know I saw his first book in the Holt's office? Did he ever tell you that? I saw his first manuscript.
No.
Those poems about God.
Yes, back in the war.
Yes.
There was one year when I lost sort of my job and I hadn't anything, and there was a lull in everything, selling books around that time. And the Holtz gave me $100 a month to live on, and with the understanding that I'd read any manuscript they sent me. And they only sent me two manuscripts for the year. And one was his poems about God, and the other I won't mention. But John was sort of my discovery. They printed him. John has repudiated those first poems, I believe. He doesn't think so much of them. He leaves them out, doesn't he?
He leaves them out.
I think he does, yes.
Entirely?
I believe so. I don't think there are any in the selection.
But he had the art, you know, and he had the tune.
He had the art from the very first.
Yeah.
The Wicked Swimmer poem is a very fine poem.
That's
first.
Right.
Okay. Oh, one of the most interesting things that I have seen recently is an essay by a couple of friends of ours, Wimsatt and Beardsley, who make that point that if in our day the old four-beat native verse, sing a song of sixpence, pocket full of rye, has come back in people like Auden and Eliot, that it doesn't introduce anything more than simply another strain on the old meter, that the really brilliant use of it has been the playing that over against the iambic pattern.
And all the years, the endless variety to that, you'd say that could get monotonous. It can't if there's enough expression in it.
I want to get Mr. Frost in a minute to read another one of his poems, if you will. It may not be one of his favorites, I don't know. Provide, provide.
Oh, yeah. The witch that came. You see, sometimes you sink right down to the beat of the meter, almost. The witch that came, the withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag. See, now you're getting off on the expression more. The picture pride of Hollywood. Too many fall from great and good for you to doubt the likelihood. Die early and avoid the fate. Or if predestined to die late, make up your mind to die in state. Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. See, the girl took my advice about that and married into Monaco. If need be, occupy a throne where nobody can call you crone. Some have relied, you see how the tune changes, have relied on what they knew, others on being simply true. What worked for them might work for you. No, then it gets another tune, you know. No memory of having starred makes up for later disregard or keeps the end from being hard. Better to go down dignified with boughten friendship at your side than none at all. Provide, provide. See, I lay on. I do that, you know, I did that in Washington with Henry Wallace sitting in front of me once when he was back doing good to everybody.
Yes.
And we were friends. He'd come to hear me. And so with him right there in front of me, I said at the end, better to go down dignified with boughten friendship at your side than none at all. Provide, provide, or somebody else will provide for you. And then I added, and how will you like that? See, the same tune all the time. Only it went off. And, he laughed, his wife, he smiled, and his wife laughed.
Speaking of tune, Yeats said that he started a poem with a little tune in his head.
Yeats said a good many things, and I've talked with him about that. He said that nothing he hated more than having his poem set to music. It stole the show. It wasn't the tune he heard in his ear. And what this other thing is, if he meant a tune, it doesn't seem to go with that, does it? If he had, Burns, without any doubt, had old music, old songs in his head that he wrote from. But I don't think that of Yeats. I don't know what he meant by that. But if he meant a tune, I have a tune, but it's a tune of the blend of these two things. Something rises. It's neither one of these things. It's neither the meter nor the rhythm. It's a tune arising from the stress on those, same as your fingers on the strings, you know. And the twang.
The twang.
Yeah, the twang of the of one on the other. And I don't know what he meant. I think he must meant what we mean from a resultant something beginning to rise from it right away when you're playing one on the other. That's what he carried. There must be a oneness as you're doing it. You aren't putting two things together, laying them together. It isn't synthetic like that.
No. It's growing a plant, not building a wall. It's something...
Growing in terms of this dominating mood, is that right, that you referred to as the germ of the poem?
Yes.
The tune is the mood groping for its logic, is
yes,
that it?
That's
something
right.
like that?
That's right. Yeah, I'm glad that we feel that way together. Yeah, you know that. Yes, when I begin a poem, I don't know. I don't want a poem that I can tell was written toward a good ending. One sentence, you know. That's trickery. That isn't it. It's got to be, you've got to be the happy discoverer of your end, you know.
That's a very fine way of phrasing it, the happy discoverer of your end. Yeah. Because otherwise it is contrived.
Yeah.
You can see it coming a mile off.
Yeah. Mile away. I've often said that another definition of poetry is dawn, that there's something dawning on you while you're writing it, and it comes off if it really dawns, when the light comes at the end, you know, and the feeling of dawn, the freshness of dawn, and that you didn't think this all out and write it in prose first and then translate it into verse, that's abhorrent.
May I change the subject a moment? Here are a couple of quotes from Edith Sitwell talking about verse texture. I'm going to show these to you, if I may, and see how you respond to these comments. Cleanth, you read them aloud.
Lo, where Meotis sleeps.
Yeah.
Hardly flows the freezing Tanais through a waste of snows.
And then what does she say about that?
She goes on to say,
apart from the beauty of the vowel sounds, the effect is produced largely by the little frozen air dying away again of the tribrach tanais. Yes. Now it's nonsense. Of all the things in that book, that anthology of hers, you know, all wildest stuff about Milton and everything, just the wildest kind of imagination, given credit where there's no credit due, you know, out and spoiling the great verse and everything. She beeps mad at me for talking this way. But it just won't do for me at all. Those essays that go with the poems, they're just comical from my point of view.
Will you please read the other comment?
Perhaps you can read it out loud.
But
to return to the caesura, if we examine these lines from the Dunciad, one cell there is, concealed from vulgar eye, the cave of poverty and poetry. Keen hollow winds howl through the bleak recess, emblem of music caused by emptiness.
Yeah.
We shall find that the slightness of the caesura in the third line I have quoted, a caesura so shallow as to be hardly perceptible, gives it a strange chilliness, which is added to by the little cold wind of the two words beginning with H in the third line. The last of these two words, because it is a one-syllabled word and has a long vowel sound, being louder than the two-syllable short-voweled hollow.
That won't do at all. It's all fantastic, you know. If you're going to read poetry like that with your fancy playing with everything and without any excuses at all. And, for instance, talking about those vowels and tanais and all that, you know, that
What carries it all off is much meaning and much dramatic meaning,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
Action in the thought and all that. And you can make, you can do almost anything with the vowels you want.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
If there's meaning enough,
yes,
in the accent.
Yes.
But, oh dear, we mustn't spend our time condemning anybody to death.
Richards has a little remark I'll read to you.
You mean I.A. Richards? Will you read him?
Such arguments, that is, arguments like yours, you see, against this attributing of special emotional effects to special metrical or sound effects, such arguments as yours do not tend to diminish the power of sound, the inherent rhythm, when it works in conjunction with sense and feeling.
That's right.
And Richards underscores the when it works in conjunction with sense and feeling.
Yeah. One of the things I notice with myself is that I can't make certain word sounds go together. Sometimes they won't say. And this has got something to do with the way one vowel runs into another and the way one syllable runs into another. And that I never knew the. I don't like to reason about that too much. I don't understand it. But I've changed lines because I couldn't say. There's something about my ear refused. And I suppose it has something to do with this vowels and consonants. You know what I've thought sometimes? That the mouth and throat are like this, and certain sounds are here, and you can't go right from this one to that one. You got to go like this. The mouth's got to be doing that inside. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. But I, gee, you know, that's so. I don't want any science of it. See, it's got to be not trial and error. You don't correct it. If you're going well, it takes care of itself. If you're going well, if you're felicitous, if you're having a happy day, well, we've come a good way, and it's fun. I don't often sit with somebody to talk about it this way. Sometimes from the platform I say some of these things, you know, and I used to do it more than I do it now. I had a notion I had to tell the public how to read lines. Then I decided, no, that's in them anyway. They all had Mother Goose and everything. Don't you see that you throw them back on their Mother Goose?
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
And then all with the play of ideas in it, how deep the Mother Goose is, you see. Pussycat, pussycat, where have you been? I've been to London to see the coronation. To pervert it a little. Yeah. Pussycat, pussycat, what'd you see there? I saw nothing but what I might have seen just as well by staying right here in Nashville. I saw a mouse run under a chair. See? And that's very deep.
Yes.
Yeah. But so pretty the way it's set off, you know. And so nobody, you know, that it, nobody needs see it at all unless they're any, you know, discerning. I saw a mouse run under a chair. That's meant a lot to me, that, as all my life.
That's a good one.
That's what makes regionalists, you see. You can stay right at home and see it all. You know, another thing I think belongs to poetry is fresh observation, don't you, all the time? Little insights. They say nothing new, but there is all the time. For instance, I was saying about women the other day, they were plaguing me to leave some boys I wanted to talk to. They thought I was getting tired or something. Finally, I turned on them, and I said, a woman would rather take care of you than listen to you think.
That's a mark of a good woman.
I softened that to him by saying, that's why we like you, my dears. You see, because we know that what we think doesn't mount much anyway. We men. But you see, that was a fresh observation.
Well, the mere observation of just the facts of the world is a constant refresher for poetry. This waking up of
That's right.
Yourself, and you get the least little turn of an observation of the way a leaf or a light is or something.
Little insights into character and a little insight, little observations of something growing, you know, outdoor or something, what life. And
one thing, that the sense of waking up that comes when you see a small but true observation of some physical fact in a poem, it wakes you up to the whole poem. It's very wonderfully, literally eye-opening.
That's right.
Well, I would like to go on with this for hours, but I don't think that we have any right to ask Mr. Frost to go further. I think we have some wonderful stuff for our table.
Well, I ought to find time.
Well, it's been... we are grateful, and many other people would be grateful, too. You've done something for more people than
I'm talking to
us.
People I know how to talk with.